This is Herb Montgomery with Renewed Heart Ministries, and I welcome you to this week's weekly podcast. This week, I want to do something a little bit different. I want to give you seven reasons why I think white Christians should be standing in solidarity with their brothers and sisters of color right now. Over the last few weeks, I've witnessed what I think is a very disturbing pushback from individuals that I respect. And this pushback is against the Black Lives Matter movement that's born out of the stories of Eric Garner, Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, and many more. And I'd like to offer just a few reasons once again why I'm convicted that as a white Jesus follower, our place is beside our brothers and sisters within the Black Lives Matter movement. Number one, Jesus's new world is not colorblind. Whenever racism is discussed, you're going to always have a few well-meaning people who try to dismiss the entire conversation by saying, I'm not colorblind. I don't see color. There's no such thing as race. We're all part of the human race. And the more we talk about this, the more we continue to keep racism alive. This actually happened to me on Facebook just this week. Part of that statement is correct. We are all part of the human race. But the idea that talking about a problem somehow keeps the problem alive, I think is misinformed at best. We can't fix a problem without talking about it, and racism is not going to go away just by simply ignoring it. Not to mention that there's a significant difference between a white person saying we're all part of the human race in an effort to shut down discussion on racism, and a person of color saying we're all part of the human race in an effort to open up the discussion and to address the blind spots of privileged white people. One is insensitive and perpetuates racism, and the other does not. My black friends will be the first to tell you that there's nothing wrong with seeing their color or their race. It's part of who they are, and there's nothing wrong with their race that I shouldn't see. It's a huge part of their identity, and the problem really is when we treat one another as less than based on their race. That is racism. Racism is a social construct that was created to divide human beings from other human beings in order to privilege some at the cost of others. When monarchies were thrown down and people began to believe that all men are created equal, hierarchy could no longer continue. It could no longer be rooted in the bloodlines of kings and queens. So hierarchy took on a new form. A new idea was created, and this was the idea that some races are superior to others, and this is how hierarchical privilege lived on. And Jesus's new world is a world where there will be equity and justice between the races, and it will not be a world where race does not exist, and thank goodness we will not all be white. Some textual background to this, you can look up Psalms 9 verse 8 and Revelation 7 verse 9. Number two, Jesus was about liberation. Out of all the Old Testament pictures of Yahweh that Jesus could have chosen, Jesus chose the advocate God, the liberator of the oppressed. You can find this in Luke chapter 4 verse 18. Jesus chose to stand in a deeply oppression-confronting prophetic lineage. In order to see this lineage for yourself, you can look up Proverbs 31, 8 through 9, Psalms 146, 6 through 7, Isaiah 10, verse 1, Isaiah 1, 17, Amos 5, 21 through 24. Each of the prophets made their respective privileged class uncomfortable by calling for systemic change as they stood in solidarity with the oppressed of their time. And James Cone, in his book, God of the Oppressed, states that any interpretation of the gospel in any historical period that fails to see Jesus as the liberator of the oppressed is heretical. This has grave implications for us as Jesus followers today. We're called to be liberators too. And this is why Cone goes on to say that any view of the gospel that fails to understand the church as that community whose work and consciousness are defined by the community of the oppressed is not Christian and is therefore heretical. And Gustavo Gutierrez, in his landmark book, A Theology of Liberation, he also wrote that the gospel itself contains the seed of liberation from all things that oppress. Number three, Jesus's liberation is from systemic sin as well as private. One of the deepest disconnects for many of my white friends is that they still are looking at these stories that are emerging from the black community as isolated and individual occurrences without connecting the dots. They want to debate the intricacies of each case individually without stepping back and looking at the big picture. And if we stop and listen first, we're going to discover that our fellow Christians of color, they overwhelmingly see these cases not as disconnected, but as one example after another of an entire systematic problem. And the stories of Eric Garner, Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, those stories somehow hit the news and caught everyone's attention, but they're not isolated occurrences. These stories are symbolic of the larger experiences and the daily experiences for people of color here in America. We follow a Jesus who came to liberate us from systemic sin as well as personal or private. And I want to share with you two more statements from Gustavo Gutierrez. He wrote in the same book, "Grace moves individually and socially. Sin is evident in oppressive structures, in the exploitation of man by man, in the domination and slavery of peoples, races, and social classes." When we focus on liberating individuals from personal sin while ignoring systemic sin, we create a reality that is deeply problematic. And let me try to illustrate why. Imagine systemic sin within a society as an automated locomotive train racing down the tracks. And we're all on this train together. And we as individuals may not participate personally in the operation of the train, yet we're still all on the train with everyone else as it's moving along. So someone can choose privately or personally to be a Jesus follower, but they're still members of a much larger society around them that is racing down a track. And just because they are not racist, it doesn't mean that they're not on an automatic train or an automated train that is. As a white follower of Jesus in society, I may be completely unaware of how vastly unfair the societal structures are, or I may know, but choose in my private life to be different. But the train that we're on is still moving us all together down the track. And some will ask, if we just focus on healing hearts, won't we heal the systems as well? And it's a beautiful thought, but it's simply not that automatic. John Newton, who was the slave trader who wrote Amazing Grace, he didn't look at the slave trade after his conversion and simply say, it'll take care of itself if we just keep converting souls. He intuitively saw the difference between systems and people who live within those systems. Just because he was converted didn't mean that the systems had changed. He immediately went to work changing the social order of slave trading in his society. If one is privately a follower of Jesus, then one should publicly be involved in ending systems of oppression and privilege. We must purposefully, just as Jesus followers, be swimming against the current, swimming up the stream, if you will forgive just the mixing of two metaphors here. It's not enough to be neutral. We have to actually be anti-racist. We must be intentionally standing against present racial inequality while we're putting on display a world that could be radically and racially different. The current train is moving down the tracks, and remaining neutral or privately non-racist isn't enough. We must privately and publicly be anti-racist. And let me add this too. Neither is it anti-police to want law enforcement systems to be fair. Today we live within an automated racist system, which is the train, so to speak, without racists, without conductors. Therefore, if we're going to be following a liberating Jesus, we, just like Jesus, must seek to take apart racist systems as well, even if we don't personally think we ourselves are being racist. As Peter Gomes stated in his book, The Scandalous Gospel of Jesus, social sin does not differ from private sin. Both stink in God's nostrils. Jesus came to heal us from more than individual and private sickness. We must not only embrace the private healing and shun the public healing. Jesus came not only to heal the heart, but to heal our sick social structures as well. And I'll come back to Jesus's healing motif when we get to number 7. But reason number 4 is that Jesus shut it down. In Mark's gospel, we get a little tidbit that is most often overlooked. In Mark 11, verse 11, it says, "Then he entered Jerusalem, went into the temple, and when he had looked around at everything, it was already late. He went out to Bethany with the 12. What this means is that when Jesus arrived at the temple, it was already too late in the day for his temple protest to accomplish his desired result. So he had to go back to Bethany and spend the night and come back the next day when there would be a sufficient amount of people to make shutting down the temple sacrifices an effective demonstration. Imagine if Jesus would have had Twitter. Luke tells us that as a result of Jesus shutting down the temple, the priests began looking for a way to put Jesus to death. And it would not be long before the temple police showed up at night with swords and clubs to arrest Jesus. And you think police brutality here. In Luke's gospel, this is Luke 22:52, it says, "Then Jesus said to the chief priests and the officers of the temple police and the elders who had come for him, 'Have you come out with swords and clubs as if I were a bandit?'" And during Jesus's trial, even Jesus was subjected to police brutality. According to John's gospel, in John 18:22, it says, "When he had said this, one of the police standing nearby struck Jesus on the face, saying, 'Is that how you answer a high priest?'" And we can respond to this in two ways. We can either say that Jesus should have not, he should have known how to talk to law enforcement respectfully, or we can see that Jesus is not being disrespectful, but that there was a much more deeply systemic problem here with a very long history. James Cone, again, in his book, God of the Oppressed, he writes, "The only meaningful Christian response is to resist unjust suffering and to accept the painful consequences of that resistance." Jesus, in shutting down the temple, he had resisted the oppression of unjust exploitation and the ecclesiastical abuse of his day. And now he has to accept the painful consequences of that resistance. To their violence, he must respond by turning the other cheek. He must love his enemies and even seek to restore them. And he must do whatever it takes to endeavor to win them away from even their own enslavement to systemic evil, even if it be through his own death and resurrection. And this is where the power, not of Jesus' death, but of the resurrection of Jesus in the narrative takes center stage. Now, Jesus' death is really nothing more than yet another lynching by those at the top of oppressive systems when their privileged way of life is threatened. You can think of the economic systems represented by Herod, the political systems represented by Pilate, and the religious system represented by Caiaphas. And at the moment of Jesus's lynching, Matthew tells us that the temple curtain was torn in two from top to bottom. And that's in Matthew 27:51. The Pharisees claimed that God dwelt at the heart of their temple, at the heart of their system of oppression. But when the curtain which covered the central room of their temple, where they said that God dwelt, when that was torn in two, it was seen that the room was empty. There was no presence, there was no Ark of the Covenant, only an empty room that was uncomfortably announcing the absence of God. Now place alongside this the story detail of the resurrection. Where the torn curtain tells us where God was not, the resurrection tells us where God actually was. God was not at the heart of that system of oppression. The resurrection reveals that God was in solidarity with the one being lynched that day. Whether it's civic violence, like through Pilate, or religious violence through Caiaphas, or economic violence through Herod, or today, whether it's racial violence at the hands of law enforcement, the Jesus story puts on display that the presence of God is not found within the most exclusive holy places belonging to those systems of oppression. The true dwelling place of the presence is found in the one that is shamefully suspended, lynched on the hanging tree at the orders of those oppressive systems. In other words, God is standing and always has stood in solidarity with those that our systemic injustice is oppressing. No matter what white theologians say, oppressive systems are not of divine origin. They're actually capable of lynching God too, if God were to come as one among us and be viewed as an intrusive threat to those systems as well. We have before us the story of, in Jesus, in the Jesus narrative, it's the story of an innocent man that was born into poverty, who questioned authority, and was unjustly executed because of it. And though through religiosity, this story, I think it loses much of its impact on us today, this story is repeated in every Eric Garner. James Cone again says in The Cross and the Lynching Tree, "The cross was God's critique of power, white power, with powerless love, snatching victory out of defeat." Reason number five, Jesus taught us actually how to protest civil justice issues effectively. Jesus gave us three examples in the Sermon on the Mount of how to protest injustice, both nonviolently and effectively. And please notice that peaceful protest and nonviolent resistance are not always the same. There's a subtle difference between passive non-resistance taught by those in positions of privilege because they would like to have their lives left undisturbed, and what Jesus taught as nonviolent, decentering, discomforting, and non-cooperation that endeavors to disturb and to wake up oppressors to their participation and perpetuation of systemic injustice. So let's look at those three examples. The first was the turning of the left cheek to be struck as a social equal instead of the humiliating backhanded slap that was on the right cheek. And this was a demeaning act in this culture. It was done by a supposed superior, like a master over a slave, a husband over a wife, a parent over a child, a Roman over a Jew, a man over a woman. Its purpose was to humiliate and dehumanize. And this is especially relevant in matters of race today. At its heart, racism dehumanizes, saying that some races are less human than others. In Jesus' example, a blow in retaliation to respond with violence would have most definitely invited an escalating retribution. But in offering the left cheek, in answer to the right cheek that was struck, and offering the left cheek, the one being dehumanized, showed that the supposed inferior, they defiantly refused to be humiliated in such a way. And with the left cheek now bared, the one struck was effectively stating that if a blow was to be given, it would have to be given on the proper cheek with a closed fist, which would have been an acknowledgement that the one struck was the social equal of their striker. And Jesus is giving the one struck basically a nonviolent way to protest the intended dehumanization of their oppressor. The second example was of standing stark naked in a courtroom setting as if to shame their oppressors. And whether we like it or not, Jesus is endorsing in this example public nudity as a valid form of nonviolent protest. And the last example is of putting the Roman soldier in the uncomfortable bind of causing them to break their own law by allowing the voluntary carrying of the conscripted burden a second mile. In each of these examples, Jesus is putting the oppressed person in charge of the moment while exposing the exploitative system and decentering, shaming, and discomforting their oppressors. And Jesus was teaching nonviolent ways for oppressed people to take the initiative and to affirm their humanity, to expose and to neutralize oppression. And Jesus is demonstrating nonviolent ways in which people at the bottom of society or under the thumb of systemic oppression, that they can learn to recover their humanity while at the same time reach out to redeem and restore those who are their oppressors. And I've written more about this online and at our website, Renewed Heart Ministries, and you can check out the series on the act of nonviolence of Jesus, where I go more into these three methods that Jesus taught. But these were methods whereby oppressed people, such as the Jews under the Romans, they could overthrow systems of injustice through waking their oppressors to their own victimhood to systemic injustice and winning their oppressors away from these systems to stand in solidarity with the oppressed. And this is what Martin Luther King refers to as the double victory. And this is actually where King got it from. In King's Christmas sermon in 1957, he preached, "We shall match your capacity to inflict suffering by our capacity to endure suffering. We shall meet your physical force with soul force. Do to us what you will, and we shall continue to love you. We cannot in all good conscience obey your unjust laws, because non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with good. Throw us in jail, and we shall still love you. Bomb our homes and threaten our children, and we shall still love you. Send your hooded perpetrators of violence into our community at the midnight hour, and beat us and leave us half dead, and we shall still love you. But be ye assured that we will wear you down by our capacity to suffer. One day we shall win freedom, but not only for ourselves. We shall so appeal to your heart and conscience that we shall win you in the process, and our victory will be a double victory. This is especially why white Christians today, most of all, should be standing alongside people of color at this moment in America. It's time for white Christians to proclaim the liberating power of Jesus and putting on display how Jesus woke them up to their own victimhood to systemic injustice as perpetrators of racial inequality. And it's time for white Christians especially to put on display a Jesus who has set them free to now stand in solidarity with those that their white forefathers disadvantaged, marginalized, and oppressed. This is what it means to announce the new world that has arrived in Jesus. And we can't close our ears, as some people are doing right now, by saying, well, maybe there's something wrong, but they're destroying their own neighborhoods, and how does that help? And I want to go on record as a Jesus follower that I do believe that nonviolent protest is a force more powerful than violent protest. But it's not my place as a white person who's benefiting from systems of oppression to dictate how those who feel harmed express their frustration. As Dr. Martin Luther King also has said, a riot is the language of the unheard. And let's assume King is right for a moment. What isn't being heard? What is it why do they feel so powerless? Why are there people who feel like violence is their only option? And yes, there are looters. But this happens every day on Wall Street too. We can't use this as an excuse to tune out the legitimate groaning of a group of people who are trying to say that their experience in this world is different than ours. And those who benefit from white privilege, we have to take great care not to do more damage by writing off the voice of the protesters because of a few who become violent. It smacks of what Broderick Greer, he tweeted recently, "So the loss of property is more important than the loss of Michael Brown's life? Hashtag capitalism." It's not the place of white Jesus followers to critique the voice of the black community who are giving voice to their oppression. A Jesus follower of color might be able to critique this, but as a white Jesus follower, I can't. I'm disqualified by my place of privilege within this system. No matter how sincere my critique may be, it will always come across as only desiring to have my place of privilege not be made uncomfortable. As a white Jesus follower, our place is to mourn with those that mourn, to lament with those that are lamenting right now, and to march with those who march nonviolently, and to participate alongside people of color in nonviolent demonstrations. The sit-ins of the 60s have now become die-ins. And all of this while we're continuing to ask ourselves, what are we not hearing? And before we judge, we have to begin to genuinely listen. Again, I do believe that nonviolence is a force more powerful, but it's not my place as a person of privilege to critique the oppressed. That only breeds further oppression. And I'm not justifying violent protest. I'm just simply saying that we should care more about the voices who feel powerless, the voices who feel like they're not being heard, the voices who feel like their only option is violence. We should care more about the value of those voices than the value of our property that's being damaged. And reason number 6, Jesus's kingdom is not a mere spiritual kingdom, not of a mere spiritual nature. When Jesus said to Pilate, "My kingdom is not of this world," in John 18:36, he was not saying that his kingdom is spiritual rather than this worldly. This is the tragic mistake of dualism. Jesus's kingdom is not of this world, meaning that his kingdom is not from this world. It doesn't operate the way kingdoms of this world operate. It's a kingdom that's really an upside down kingdom, or an unkingdom, so to speak, where there's no hierarchy. Jesus also refers to the kingdom as being of heaven. And he doesn't say that his kingdom was in heaven. Rather, it was a kingdom of or from heaven that has come to earth. Jesus taught us to pray, "Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven." That's Matthew 6:10. And in Matthew 5:5, Jesus doesn't say, "Blessed are the meek, for they will go to heaven." He says, "Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth." The arrival of Jesus's kingdom, or this new world that we find through Jesus here on earth, It contains significant implications for the present social structures of Jesus' day. And these implications are outlined by Jesus in Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is not telling of a future post-mortem heaven that one could be assured of by experiencing some personal, private, individual, spiritual renewal now. Rather, Jesus is announcing that if you're hungry, if you're weeping, if you're mourning, or you're hated because of the present system, this new world that he had come to found was especially for you. It was a message of liberation now for those who are presently oppressed. And the arrival of Jesus' unkingdom, it marked the beginning of a new world of restoration, liberation, redistribution, and a rearrangement of how life on earth was structured. You can see this in Luke 6, verses 20 through 26. And I give a more detailed explanation of how Jesus' Sermon on the Mount was announcing liberation to the oppressed on our website as well. If you go to renewedheartministries.com and go to our audio presentations, you'll find a series entitled God is Beautiful, and you want to listen to the Advocate God presentation there. This is why Jesus' followers of the first century were seen as such a threat to the elite and the privileged of their day. If the Jesus followers of the first century were only endeavoring to promote a spiritual kingdom, then Rome would never have given it a second thought. Instead, those at the top of their social conventions felt especially threatened by this new Jesus movement. And some will say, but this all sounds too political. And I would answer to that political doesn't even go far enough. Not only does Jesus' new world confront political systems, it confronts social systems and ecclesiastical or religious systems and economic systems as well. Wherever there is oppression, Jesus stands in solidarity with the oppressed, being the beacon of liberation from both private and social evil. Notice how politically, socially, and economically and ecclesiastically challenging the early church really was. In Acts 16:31, in protest to calling Caesar Lord, they proclaimed that Jesus was Lord. In Acts 9:20, in protest to calling Caesar the Son of God, they proclaimed that Jesus was the Son of God. In Acts 10:36, in protest to the Pax Romana, or the peace that came through Roman occupation, the peace of Rome, they proclaimed the Pax Jesus Christo, or the peace that comes through Jesus Christ. In John 4:14, in protest to Rome being called the Savior of the world, they proclaimed that Jesus was the Savior of the world. Jesus calls us to make disciples of the nations. We're not only to call individuals to follow Jesus, but the systems and structures of the nations as well. And all nations includes America. If you want to take a look into the textual evidence for this cry, not just to individuals, but to the nations as well, I'll give you a few passages here. You can look up Acts 17:5-7, Matthew 28:18-17, Acts 23:11, Revelation 14:6, Revelation 15:3-4, Daniel 7:13-14, and Revelation 21, verse 22 through chapter 22, verse 2. But again, all the nations, it includes America. And as Jesus' followers, we're to call the nations to abandon their abuse of humanity and to follow the teachings of Jesus as well. This is radically different, though, than calling on America. This is not the Christian right. This is not calling on America to enforce Christian values, which is often by the sword. This, I think, would be an abandonment of the teachings of Jesus by the Christians themselves who called for such a thing. This is a call for America, as well as all the nations, to no longer be conduits of oppression, to no longer depend on systems of injustice, but to submit themselves to the liberating new world that has arrived in Jesus too. And lastly, reason number 7, Jesus came to heal the world. Jesus emphatically taught that his purpose in coming to this world was to heal it. In John 17:3-17, Jesus says to Nicodemus that night, God did not send the Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be healed. And remember that word there, sozo. Salvation for Jesus meant healing. Nowhere in the Gospels do we ever find Jesus going around trying to get people to say a special prayer so they could go to heaven when they died. Jesus wasn't focused on getting people to heaven at some point in the future. Jesus was focused on bringing heaven into people's lives in the here and in the now today. For Jesus, salvation meant healing. And when he sent his first followers out themselves, he told them not only to proclaim the good news of this radically new world, that had arrived, he told them also to heal the sick as well. And you can find this in Matthew 10 verse 8, Luke 9 verse 2, and Luke 10 verse 9. There are more sicknesses in this world than mere physical sickness. There's social sickness, ecclesiastical sickness, political sickness, and economic sickness. And to get a more broad look at this concept, you can check out a presentation on our website. It's actually this month's featured presentation entitled A Time for Change. You can find that on our homepage. But Jesus died to liberate us, not from the evils of a future disembodied age, but according to Galatians 1:4, to set us free from the present evil age. White Christians, and praise God for the few exceptions, historically have been too busy saving people's souls for eternity to even consider the bondage to social injustices and oppression that their potential converts are under in the present. We don't look at physical sickness, such as cancer, and refuse to search for a cure, saying this will not be solved till Jesus' return. Why should we do this with social, political, ecclesiastical, or economic sicknesses? Why should we do this with the cancer of systemic racism? What would Jesus have you do right here, right now? Well, some have said, why don't we just focus on Syrian Christians who are suffering at the hands of ISIS in the Middle East rather than civil racial equality issues here in America? And to those, I would ask, why assume that racial inequality here is not affecting your brother and sister Christians as well? In all actuality, the question itself is born out of an experience that's only rooted in white theology. White theology is not standard, default, real theology. There's no such thing as just theology. All theology is done from someone's vantage point. And it's time that we start naming what is passed as theology as really white theology. And we need to allow other voices, other theologies that are speaking from different vantage points of oppression. We allow those voices to be heard as well. ISIS is a rebellion against the oppressive empires of the West that are associated with empirical Christendom. Nonviolent non-cooperation or protest, it was never something Jesus offered to empires as a means of defeating insurrections, but something that Jesus offered insurrectionists as a powerful means of overthrowing oppressive empires. And I write more about that if you look in our eSites of last month when I did an eSite on ISIS. You can find that on our eSites page at renewedheartministries.com if you'd like more information on that. But most importantly, the fight with ISIS for most of us in the States is far, far away rather than right in front of us. And the fact that we would rather identify with Syrian Christians thousands of miles away rather than our fellow Black Christians right here is very telling. Syrian Christians are at a safe distance away, and we'll likely never meet them. We'll likely never have to wrestle with their narratives. We can speak about our solidarity with them without ever having to bear a cross or a lynching tree with any of them. And right before us is a very tangible but costly option. The stories of our Black brothers and sisters are stories that we cannot project our own stories onto to justify our solidarity with them. These stories call us like none other presently to embrace what has too long been labeled, even among Christians, as the other or as equal but separate. It's time to embrace the liberating narrative of Jesus and to choose to stand in solidarity and to stand against systemic racial injustice that is all around us here in the States. Matthew 10, 7 through 8, Jesus says, "As you go, proclaim this message, the kingdom of heaven has come near, and heal the sick." In James Perkinson's book, White Theology, he writes, "Until the white body writhes with red rage, until the white heart heaves with black tremors, until the white head bows before yellow dreams and tan schemes and olive screams, for a different world, any communion claimed will be contrivance of denial. A theologian speaking of resurrection in a body not bearing the scars of their own crucifixion? Impossible." Drew G.I. Hart, in his Twitter feed last week, wrote, "White Christians that refuse to affirm that Black lives matter are rejecting the concrete option for Christian solidarity in the way of Jesus." Dr. Cornell West, the great Dr. Cornell, he writes, "If your success is defined by being well-adjusted to injustice, to being well-adapted to indifference, then we don't want successful leaders. We want great leaders who love the people enough and respect the people enough to be unbought, unbound, unafraid, and unintimidated to tell the truth. And Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. wrote, "True peace is not the absence of conflict, but the presence of justice." The resurrection assures us that we don't need to fear our engagement against systemic injustice, racial or otherwise. We stand in the victory of Christ over all injustice, and that's a victory that has already been won. Please accept my humble apologies this week for departing from our Advent series. This was on my heart, and really, isn't the coming of the one who set the oppressed free really what Advent is all about? I love each of you. I'll see you next week. Till the only world that remains is a world where love reigns. Check out these hashtags: Black Lives Matter, Hands Up, Don't Shoot, I Can't Breathe, God Can't Breathe, Jesus Can't Breathe, Solidarity Jesus, and Jesus Shut It Down. I'll see you next week.